Mike? Let's see. I don't know if he hears me. Okay. Tina, audio is still good? Ryan? Just give me an okay and we'll start the class.
Rabbi?
Yes.
The audio is much better today than it was in the last couple of weeks. I don't know.
On the internet or on the phone?
No, on the phone.
Oh, okay.
It was very bad.
Yeah, that alters. That seems to be the service.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, good.
All right, everything's good, so we're going to get going now. Okay, so we're up to 8-8. All right, anybody have any questions or comments before we start regarding what we did up to this point? Okay, so the context that we're dealing with is going to be important to explain the next verse. And you need also the commentaries too to help out. So I'll just read it, and I'll explain it using some of the commentaries too. So King Solomon says in 8:8 in Kohelis that man does not have the ability to rule over his spirit, to contain his spirit within him, to keep it from leaving him, meaning he has no control over his life. Right? That means that, and we'll see in the commentaries, that everybody dies. Then he says that there's no ruling on the day, to the first word, ruling, that means that he has no control. Second one seems to be, by the commentators, meaning to be like the kingship over his soul. What did he say? He says the second point is that there's no rulership, or a person can't act as a king on the day of his death. And there's no, when it comes to battles, to have, when you draw close, when you have somebody who you send out, that is not going to help you at all in terms of saving life when you go to war. And the resha, something which the evil will not save its owner. Evil here, it seems that the commentaries are saying that it's talking about money. As Ibn Ezra says, he says, some of the commentators say, what does it mean that the evil won't save a person? It means to say that since most of the money the person gathers is in evil methods. Right, again, he's not talking about every single case, but it would seem to be what he's saying is he's implying that money is equated with evil because many people go after it and only want the money and don't care who they step on or what shrewd and unjust measures they take to accumulate more wealth. Because the wealth is really their objective, not concern for the fellow man or honesty. So whenever you have a desire that's stronger than the other ones, you can be sure that the other ones will be compromised because you're going after what's the strongest desire. And that's why a person who's not in control of his morality, he can't learn, the rabbis say. Because if a person's not in control of his morality and he goes after desires all the time, so how is he going to learn something? What's the problem? What's the problem with a person like that? Why can't a person who's immoral still learn ideas?
Because they're not disciplined to do that. They're just following their emotions.
They're not, what do you mean, they can't sit down with a book or a rabbi? What do you mean?
Well, they're drawn to their emotions and what they want to do, that study and learning takes a discipline.
Well, let's say that they sat down and they could open a book and then read. What would be the, they still would be able to learn. Well,
they're not into like the abstract thinking, and they're too much into their own needs, maybe.
Well, you have people that are very successful business people. They're very into their desires, and they hoard a lot of wealth, and they can think pretty abstractly.
Or maybe the emotions just affect them too strongly for them in that particular area.
How exactly? Yeah, specifically though, how does it stop them from learning? If a person's overly attached to desires, to lusts, to pleasures, what exactly is the reason? What technically prevents them from learning a new idea? Just one idea. We want to teach them a new idea. Why can't they?
Trying to amass this, whatever they're going after, and they probably feel that the time that they're spending learning is taking away from accomplishing what they really want to get out of life.
Well, let's say it's the day's over. They're tired. They did all the work for the day, and now they're still, you know, they're awake. Why can't they open a book and get a new idea? And just put on your mute, please, when you're not speaking, because you're getting some static. See, the reason is because if a person hears an idea and it conflicts with his desires, he'll reject the idea. Again, since his motivation in life is a desire or lust, so whatever he's going after, that's what he really wants. So whatever's going to be the most powerful force that motivates the person, everything else he will compromise. He'll reject the idea, or he'll say the idea is foolish, or he'll say that's not what it means, in order that he can retain the life of the desires that he wants. That's why a person who's immoral cannot learn. That's why it says, Derech Eretz Kavan LaTorah, that having correct, refined morality is a prerequisite for acquiring Torah knowledge. All right, everybody see it? It's internally a hurdle to learning, because you have an agenda. Your agenda is to justify a lifestyle of hedonism. So when you're taught that you can't do this, you're going to reject it. It'll take time for a person like that to actually see the truth and to actually have a teacher that can educate him objectively and say, you remove yourself from your desires and just look at this just in terms of truth. The best way to approach something like that is you teach the person something which he has no emotions attached to. Then he can think objectively. And then you show him, okay, you just thought objectively here, and then you try to apply that slowly to his own life. So that's why it's a very good maneuver when you're speaking to somebody to take the person away from having to answer for himself. Remove him from the equation. I was talking with somebody recently, and he had a Jewish upbringing. He had Torah studies, high school, college, but now he's like a skeptic. And the way skeptics work is they just, you know, they feel they can have one hole in something. There's some unanswered question that justifies a complete rejection of the entire Torah. Because if they can find one area that there's no answer to, that's how they work. The thinking is distorted. Whereas you take them in the same area, they have a doctor that's been right 100 times. And in one case, he's not sure whether or not, you know, this doctor is going to be right or not. But this doctor's got a better track record than every other doctor. In that case, he'll definitely follow the doctor with a better track record. But then he's in a contradiction, because why doesn't he say, well, there's an unanswered question over here by this doctor, therefore everything, you know, I'm going to nullify everything. I'm not going to follow him. Because you see there, he's got no emotion in the area to reject the doctor. Just the opposite. He's in need of a doctor. So, but in terms of how it's very helpful, like if a person is, I was talking to this person, and he's rejecting proof of Torah from Sinai. Why? Because there's no artifacts. There's no evidence of 2.5 million Jews wandering the desert for 40 years. There's no evidence to that. Not that there should be any. I mean, there was no waste. The clothes grew with them miraculously. They didn't build settlements. There was no cement structures. There wasn't any type of packaged goods that they would leave in garbage cans. So, and they also didn't even know the exact path that they took in order to locate. But the way you can approach a person like that is you can ask him, okay, don't ask him what he thinks. Ask him, well, what do you think the reasoning was that all the great rabbis, the greatest thinkers, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Sforno, Ibn Ezra, all these, the Khuzari, why did they all accept Sinai as being true? Don't ask him for his opinion. Ask him to explain why they might have accepted it as true. Since they did, what might their reasoning be? So now you remove the person from having to answer for himself, but now he's not putting himself on the line. He might feel a little at ease, and he could give some reason why these great thinkers might have accepted Sinai. And once you can get him into that mode of thinking where he's not putting himself on the line, now you can engage him, and perhaps he can engage, you know, objective ideas. It may depend on the person, the personality, and so on, but it's an important lesson. All right. Okay, so let's get back to our verse over here. So our verse has four parts. Again, a person cannot rule over his spirit in order to retain it in his body, to hold back his day of death. There's no kingship, there's no rulership on the day of death, even if it's not your time, according to the commentaries. Meaning the first part is talking about when it is your time. So when your time is up, that's it. You have no way to fight that. Everybody dies. And if it's a death which comes suddenly or with some circumstance, you get into a car accident, so then there also, there's not going to be any way that you can control. That's number two. Number three, in terms of going to battle, there's no control you have over your life in that case. And the wealth of a person is not going to do anything for him in terms of saving him. He will not escape through being wealthy. Okay. So the first question you have is, what is this verse doing here? We've been explaining everything up to this point in terms of there being a context and being a sequence. How might this fit into the sequence is my first question. And the second question is, what are the different divisions of the verse? How can we define these four elements of the verse? So what were we discussing up to this point? The person shouldn't be brazen to walk away from the king. He shouldn't, because that'll ultimately be evil if he disobeys God. In verse 3, and God will certainly do all that he desires. I mean, punishment is inescapable. And 4, King Solomon talked about that God rules over everything. Who's going to tell him what to do? And in 5, we talked about how the person keeps the commands, which he has to keep. So the general rule is that it'll be a better life. It'll be a good life. He won't see any evil. And the wise person knows, the one who's wise in his heart, knows that there's a time and place for everything. Meaning he won't try to attack the Torah by saying, oh, look, you know, I was righteous in this case, I was charitable in this case, and it blew up in my face. That we talked about last week. Person knows when it's the right time to placate. He knows when it's the right time to give. He knows when it's the right time to speak to somebody, when not to speak. But we said that King Solomon was saying all this because you see that the Torah in his very first verse in 8, when he talked about how there's no one like a wise man, he understands the interpretation of a matter. Because it illuminates his face, means it gives the person pleasure, But the last part, what does it say? The brazenness of his face turns away, meaning the ego, the arrogance of a person is diminished when he becomes a Torah student. And that's where I believe he went on from that point for the rest of this whole chapter up to this point. He stressed specifically in verse 3 how a person should be excited before God. And that he should leave and abandon God's system. He explains, because listen, that you're going to hurt yourself, there'll be punitive measures. And anything that God wants, he made the world. So who are you to say that this is not the right thing to do? But he's speaking against what part of the person in all these cases? What's the element in man that King Solomon is addressing? He's trying to correct.
Person thinks he's immortal.
Okay, immortality, that's in our verse. I agree. But before...
Ego.
What was the last one?
The ego.
Right, ego. Ego. A certain amount of arrogance.
Right.
A desire for just doing things his own way. That's freedom we spoke about.
Rabbi?
So, yeah?
Also, I think, in my own humble opinion, I think it takes a tremendous weight off him if he finally realizes that there's a creator and he's not the one that's making his sales happen, that's making anything happen, that there's a creator who's running the world. I think, number one, it puts him down a few steps. And number two, I think it takes a tremendous weight off him because he knows then that it's not all on him, that if he prays and he does the right thing, good things will come back, reward and punishment. I'm sensing that's what I've seen. But okay. I don't think that's the whole thing. I think there's so much more.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in this area here, what he's addressing... You're right, Doug, maybe immortality and Rivka about ego. But there's a rebelliousness in the person. That's why he tells the person, don't leave from before the king. Don't stand in an evil area, meaning once you leave before the king, you're going to definitely be involved in something which is detrimental to yourself. Number one, you're going to have punitive measures at the end of 3. Number two, everything which God decided, that's an absolute. So there's a part of the person we talked about a number of times, that a person wants to have complete autonomy, complete freedom, no restraint. So he tries to show a number of arguments for the person. Inherently, it's no good. It'll be evil. You'll get punished. And what God decided is something which is absolute. You can't change it anyway. Who's going to tell him what to do? Meaning to say, at the end of 4, your desire to change or to act freely is impossible anyway. You're going to meet with failure. And on top of that, if you do follow what he says, you'll have a good life. That's verse 5. And keep in mind that you have to know when and where, you know, when the mitzvahs are to be applied, when not. He qualifies that. All right, and he underlines that again at the end of 6, where he says there's a time and place for everything. It's only that the timing, person doesn't know when, where, so then it's the person's foibles. That's the person's error, because he doesn't know when and where. And he says that in 7, because the person doesn't know when something is going to be. And when it happens, how does he know that it's the right time to do something? When does he know that the right economic climate is proper to make that investment he's been waiting on? It may, first of all, he doesn't know when it's going to be proper. And even when it is, there's just too many variables that he doesn't have the knowledge of all those variables. But now I think what he does is he hits what we call a home run with his last verse. What's the one thing he's now saying in our new verse, in 8, in order to really, drive the point home?
Well, if you don't know all those other things, you also don't know when you're going to die.
Right. But even more, you don't know when. What's even more primary to knowing when you're going to die?
How?
Excuse me?
How one is going to die.
I didn't hear. What was the answer?
How?
No.
Well, I wouldn't say if somebody's going to die. Everybody dies.
Okay, that's the answer. You may not want to have said it, but that's it. Meaning when and where and all, that's accidental of the fact that you're going to die. That's what he's saying. He's telling you that in terms of accepting the whole situation, the event, the reality that we live in. So what? See, a person will fight and he'll kick and he'll scream about a lot of things in life, and he'll rebel and he feels that he can. I'll work it out myself. I'll make my decisions and so on and so forth. But what's the one lesson that shows a person that he's not in control? That he dies. See, that's why I think he culminates with this verse here before he moves on to a new point. That he says that a person doesn't even rule over his own life. And then he'll break down an elaboration of that in this verse, but I believe that's how it fits in with his whole, his sequence over here. That he's showing the person that here's the ultimate proof that you should really comply with reality, because you're going to be forced against your own will to anyway. You're not going to live forever. So I believe that's the most powerful, that's the most potent argument you give. You don't give it right away. He's showing the different angles, but then he says to the person, after all is said and done, that if you can accept that, and like you're saying, Doug, the immortality, if that's something which you can realize is not true, and you can accept that you have no control in that area, perhaps that might be an opening for the person to accept that just like that is under God's design and it has to happen to you, so the rest of what he said before this. Okay? That's why he says in the beginning of 8, a person does not rule over his spirit. So if you don't rule over that, you see that everything is following God's design, that should be the most potent lesson in terms of this really bringing home the points he's been saying up to this verse. And he's doing this for the benefit of the person, that the person is naturally inclined towards wanting autonomy, freedom, to rebel, to just do what he wants, not to have restraint in the Torah system. That's something which is just infantile to the person. But if the person will recognize a number of components to that, that the system that God created isn't absolute, there's no changing it, and it is for the good, and there is punitive part to it. Now, if you can accept that, that's great. But if you can't, then let him recognize, let him contemplate the fact that one day he's going to die and he has no control over death. Now, that should help a person loosen his grip on that desire for freedom. If he can finally relinquish and he accepts he's really, he's put here by God and he's going to be taken away by God. Now, if a person can accept that and see that that is a reality, no matter how much it disturbs him, but if the mind could at least wrap itself around that reality, now that can be a springboard to accepting the system and seeing that's a good. Because that's a foolish thing to fight. Person sees that he's aging. Person sees that everybody dies. There's no escape. No escape. Okay. All right, so everybody sees that in terms of how it fits into the sequence of the verses?
Yep.
Okay. Now he's going to elaborate. And maybe you can tell me now that now that he made that point, but still is going to be a little bit of rebellion left in the person. And where is that rebellion going to come from? That's the three other parts of the verse. The first part of the verse is the fact that a person does not rule over his spirit to contain it in his body. Now, what does he have to say further? What are the three other components of this verse doing? He talks about kingship. Let me just give you the commentary, the benefit, because I have the, I don't know if you have the English in the Ibn Ezra this morning, so let me read it to you. Okay, let's do Ibn Ezra first. This is 8:8 in Kahelis. And he says, a person doesn't rule over spirit to contain it in his body. And he says, even if a person did know when he's going to die, what benefit is it going to help him? Because a person has no ability to retain his spirit in his body or to prevent death. Okay. And he says, that's the first part. Then he says there's no rulership. He says it will not help the kingship of a king, nor will it help the one who's appointed to go out to war in a battle. All right, so he addresses number two and number three in one breath over there. He says, well, the king is not helped by his kingship in this matter, nor is the one who goes who wages war. And then he says, what does it mean by the last part? And the evil will not save its owner. So we said already, evil really means money, which is many times accumulated in evil ways. So money, so he's talking money. So the first thing is kingship. The second thing is war, battle. And the last thing is money. He's saying all these three are not going to help you in this area. Death is something which meets everybody. So what is Ebenezer saying? See, if you look at the categories, what is kingship? That's status. That's ego. The status of a person socially. How does he stand in relationship to everybody else? Well, and the king. Rashi says that the person can't prevent the angel of death from taking his soul. But then he says about a king, he says, the rulership of any king is not recognized on the day of his death. In every place in the Torah you find where it's talking about, quote unquote, and the King David, such and such. But on the day of King David's death, how does it call him? And he cites Kings 1, chapter 2, verse Aleph, the first verse. He says, and they drew close the days of David to die. There it doesn't say King David. So Rashi is saying, you see how the Torah is consistent. That just like King Solomon is saying here, that kingship does nothing for you on the day of your death. So in all places it talks in the Torah, it refers to David as King David. But on the day of his death, it just refers to him as David. Meaning the status of king no longer had any application. To teach you that it doesn't help on the day of death. Okay. But again, why is he mentioning this? Okay. So you think about it for a moment. You tell me.
Well, it seems to be saying that no status is going to help you and that everybody, in a sense, is equal on the day of death.
Right.
In the sense death doesn't discern what your position is.
Right. Now, why does he have to tell it to us? What would we have thought? Evidently, he's addressing a false notion. But he needs to address it, because why?
Maybe we would have the false notion that a king or someone in great power somehow has more power over the day of death.
Yeah. It's foolish when we put it that way, because of course not. But he's doing exactly that, like Doug said, that a person in their life will chase down, I believe what he's isolating over here to be three major pitfalls. But society praises them. To be in a position of leadership, right, fame, to be in a position of power, that's what he mentioned the next thing about war, or to be in a position of wealth. So a person, if he reads this verse and really sees how clear King Solomon is making this, it can help him release himself from pursuing this, because the real strength of the pursuit of fame and power and wealth is an unconscious idea that this is an absolute good that will last forever. That's a very, very important idea that, but people don't ever sense it, they don't vocalize it, it's unconscious. And that's why the society today, people by the millions can chase after wealth. People could want to run to be president and spend so many hours and millions and months on the campaign trail and exhaust themselves because of that, the vision they have of themselves as being that leader or power, whatever is going to be the expression of power today, whether it's in battle, whether it's going to be in a business deal or taking over this conglomerate, because sometimes money is tied up with power. But what is the driving force behind the person who lives a life this way? He feels it's permanence. A person would not do that if he felt tomorrow he's going to die. He wouldn't do any of these things. Because he's realized, well, what good is it going to be if I only have it for 24 hours? But a person could push off his death to such a point where he even thinks, it happens to everybody else, not going to happen to me. And it is a very strong emotion because that's all we know. When all you know is this life, so you tend to think that that's all there is. But that's it's a fallacy. A person has to really, at the same time that he recognizes that he's here and this is what he knows, he also has to have, one eye on the grave. He has to know that this is not everything. This is just the first phase of our existence. So that's what I believe King Solomon is doing here is he's describing the strength of the emotion that people have in these three areas and why they have it. But the way he tries to loosen a person from that, because that's really not going to help your soul. That's not going to help the part of you that survives death. So why invest your whole life in just putting away more and more and more money? That's not something which really helps you. Yeah, of course you have to live. So you work. You temper your involvement in that with your soul. You have to be interested more primarily in what you're doing to benefit your soul. And of course, it's a more pleasant life here when a person is not caught up with the fantasies. All right, so you see what he's doing now. Now we understand why he mentions these few points in this verse, because that's really what the primary goals of people are going after. They're unquestioned, they just follow society. But the reason why they can go after it is because they can deny that there's going to be an end to the enjoyment of their wealth, or the fame, or the power. So he shows, nope, none of these things are going to help you on the day of death. Right between the eyes, he shows you. All right, let's stop here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi, these all seem to be like they're methods of control in a person's life. And that what he's saying is, even if you control these things while you're alive, you cannot control death when it comes for you.
You mean another angle, that these might be areas that a person will feel that he can't control, so he has to counter that. But the way he's saying it, it seems to be saying, as we said, that these things will not help you. Meaning the rulership is not going to have any, it's not going to help you all on the day of death. It's not going to save you from death. And nor is going out for war going to help you. Because if in battle you're going to die, that's it. That power that you have, don't think that's going to do anything in terms of preventing you from death, and neither is money. The money would not help you escape. But I mean, I agree with your point that these areas cause a person to be disillusioned. But it may be, I'm not sure we're putting the cart before the horse, because is it that when they're involved in the money, so then that causes them to feel an immortality fantasy more than somebody else? Or is it that the person has an immortality fantasy, and therefore he goes after money because he feels he'll always be here to spend that money? It could be that they're both true. One feeds off the other. I would tend to say that the immortality fantasy is part of our design, just like happiness and anger is part of our design. That's not something that has to be taught. A child does not have to be taught how to be angry if somebody takes his toy. That's an inherent faculty. So also a permanence, a feeling of permanence here, I believe, is part of our makeup. And it's necessary. Because a person has to feel that he's here for a while if he's really going to go out, get a job, build a home, start a family. He has to feel, he can't be morbid. He can't be feeling that, you know, this afternoon I'm going to die. He's not going to have motivation.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Oh, Jim, I don't know if this is the point you were making, but it occurs to me that two things. One, we do actually take steps to avoid that we think are reasonable, practical steps, like if I'm going to go out to war, I make sure that my flanks are covered and my men are wearing, you know, body armor, or if I'm going in my car, I put my seatbelt on, and maybe I only fly on those airlines that I think do good mechanical work on their airplanes. In other words, practical things we do to avoid death, but at the same time, the verse seems to be saying, yeah, that may be all fine and good, but at the end of the day, you really don't know, and that could be helpful or it could not. And I wonder, too, if we don't think about the day of death because if you thought about that every second, you couldn't really operate. I mean, you know, you get up, you get dressed, you go to work, you get on the bus. I mean, probably nobody that gets on the bus going to work that day thinks they're going to die that day or they're going to die on the bus, because it's... And it kind of comes home to them a little bit when a close friend dies or a relative or someone they know. But then in order to sort of psychologically function, we operate on the basis that things have a certain continuity to them, and that, you know, I'm alive now, I was alive yesterday, so I guess I'll be alive tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's the healthy approach. I agree with you.
Okay.
Yeah. See, I think here again, just going back to the point of the context that we're in, he's trying to address the person who's, you know, kicking and screaming and doesn't want to follow the Torah system. So a intelligent person, you know, needs less to hear this verse. The person who accepts that, then he can really embrace the fact that he should be directed by an intelligent being that created the entire world. If a person can embrace the fact that I should comply with reality and not the opposite, not try to force reality into the way, you know, my desires are, the person can really relinquish his agenda. It's just like he looks at a doctor to tell him exactly what to do for his body. If he can look to God to tell him exactly what to do in terms of his philosophy, so then he's not the one that has to be smacked in the head with the stark reality of death that's inescapable. I think he's already accepted that. But this is really for the person who's, you know, King Solomon is admonishing. Don't try to leave from before the presence of the king. Don't stand in an evil matter, which must be what you're doing if you don't follow the Torah. You're going to get punished, and whatever God decided, he did already. So it seems it's a specific type of person that he's addressing here. But you're saying, Doug, yes, a person has to have... it's actually a verse. I don't know if he did it yet, but here it's in Mishlei. I believe it's here, where he says, and also the world he planted in his heart, in order they shouldn't see the end. Meaning, King Solomon said at one spot that God created the immortality fantasy, because there is a need for that sense of continuity, as you put it. It talks about in 7:4, the heart of the wise man is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fool is in the house of the party. gold implanted in his heart. Does that sound familiar to anybody? I think it's in chapter 7 or 10. The point was that God, with his wisdom, gave man the sense of permanence.
So, Rabbi, you're saying that the wise man knows that there's going to be an end of life.
Right, but what I'm saying now is that, to Doug's point, is that a person has to have a sense of permanence in order that he can function. And it's a verse that God wrote, also the world, Gamas Olam Nosan Belivam, Levilti, that they shouldn't see the end of the matter. I'll try to find it.
Okay.
Let me see if we can find this here. I can't find it right now. Yeah, I can't seem to find. All right. Let me just go back to you and see if you have any questions. You see how the verse initially seems like enigmatic, but he spent time in it, and then you see how he breaks it open, and he gives the principle in the beginning, and then shows how it breaks down to the major areas of instinct that man follows. Because a person really does feel that, that's why he puts his energy into these areas. And even after he puts his energy into the areas, he feels that this is the way it's going to be forever. He feels a certain permanence too. Jim, say your point again. I just want to make sure I'm answering it properly.
Actually, the point that you went on to make really is that I just saw this as, not even necessarily dealing with the point of immortality, but a man doesn't wish to serve God. He doesn't wish to do the Torah. And Solomon has corrected him and said, why not do the will of the king? And it seems that part of his argument here is just, you can't even control when you die, no matter how powerful you are. If you have money, if you're a king, if you have armies, none of that's going to stop death. So you should serve the one who can take your life from you.
Right. Yeah, a person feels that he does have all that, that's somehow it's a good to go after.
Yes. I think I'm just agreeing with your point, but I think I said it weird or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's always different angles. I mean, the two angles don't have to be, in conflict either. It's like I was saying, it doesn't, the person could feel motivated into these areas because the immortality exists first, and it goes into areas that he feels that he wants to spend his immortal existence in, whether it's money or fame or whatever, or it could be once he has it, So that gives him a grip, or a more tighter grip on his feeling of immortality. But when he talks here, the starting point that King Solomon is talking about is that to fully accept the reality that we live in, so the last stronghold the person will use as a defense and as a rebelliousness against trying to follow the Torah. He'll say, well, listen, here's one area you're going to have to admit that you have no control over, and that's your day of death. So from there, hopefully that'll be a good starting point to get a person to relinquish his rebelliousness in other areas too. That's how I put it. All right, any other questions or comments? If we don't have any, if you have questions on other things too, because we have still a little time, but that wraps what I wanted to discuss today.
I think we're good here.
Okay.
Rabbi, there was an interesting correlation between my learning for school and my learning here. You were talking at the beginning about an immoral person not being able to learn because the idea conflicts with his emotions. And I've been reading Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. When Constantine came to power, he wanted Constantinople to reflect what he felt his glory was. But the Roman Empire had fallen to a real ignorance. I mean, there was very little learning going on, and the sciences hadn't been progressing. So there was nobody to create this great architecture to his glory. So he opened up these schools for the sole purpose of raising architects who could, create something glorious, like from the early days of the Republic. And of course, they couldn't do it. I mean, because that's not why you learn. So what they had to do eventually was just strip the idols out of other cities and put his name on them and put them in Constantinople and say, this statue of Apollo is really Constantine now.
Really? I mean, there was such a hedonistic culture back then, you mean, so they didn't have the ability to, how would architecture be something which is a conflict with their hedonistic lifestyle? Why would that be posing a conflict to them?
Well, what Gibbon says that happened is that they just started studying the Greek text, but they weren't furthering learning themselves. So it was really a lot of vanity that was going on, is that they weren't really engaged in the love of ideas. They did it out of pomposity, but they didn't want to know things. And I think that's why the architecture fails, because they don't want to know how to make something, substantive and perhaps even beautiful.
Right.
They're just exercising their vanity.
So they just, if it didn't translate into satisfying a lust, it had no appeal to them.
Exactly.
That's a good additional angle, meaning not only will a person not be able to learn because the idea conflicts with his desires, but it's something which doesn't in any way contribute. I mean, the other extreme. Either a person won't learn because it conflicts with his desires, or it doesn't contribute to his desires. That's what you're saying, the other side of the pole.
Yeah.
That's good. That rounds out the both ends of that emotional spectrum, why a person will not enjoy knowledge. It's either telling him that his lusts are wrong, or it's not increasing his lusts. It's trying to take away his lusts, or it's not growing them. So either one will be something a person rejects. But I wonder what they did back then in order that they had, success, economically. What were they doing all day if they were just indulging pleasures?
Well, it doesn't sound like by the time of Constantine there's a whole lot of economic growth going on.
Yeah. I guess
and a lot of it was done by reading other cultures, so they'd go in and, steal their wealth.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. I guess back then, the person lived on his own land, and then he produced whatever crops, milk, cheese, food, you know, meat, eggs, everything. They were pretty self-sufficient, you know, during those times. It wasn't like what you had today, where, you know, you work in banking, you work in this, and then you have to have, you know, currency in order to exchange for your, you know, your fundamental needs. It was different.
I'm not sure how different it is. I think that a lot of the learning that goes on in our universities is actually quite similar, that it's not done for wisdom, it's not done out of a love of learning, it's done so that somebody can just get a job, which means that they don't round out their character.
Right.
They only learn what seems applicable, and they don't necessarily further the learning in their field, and not even that far. A lot of the symptoms that Gibbon finds in the Roman Empire during its decline seem to parallel things that are happening in our culture now.
That's a pleasant thought.
I just like to cheer everybody up with my happy, you know, musings on the decline of America.
Hey, Jim. In your reading, do you get a sense for how old Constantine was when he was doing all that stuff?
Let me see. He was around 30 when he came to power, and then, but he was actually then seized the full reins of power. I want to say he was 40 or 50. I can look it up.
Well, the reason I was thinking that is, it seems like, you know, when you go to all that trouble, and any of the world rulers, when they go to all that trouble to have things, like, erected in their honor and so forth, it would seem like he would be in an incredible denial about the fact that, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, or maybe 40 if you're really lucky, let's say the guy's 50 at the time, that he's not going to be around. You know, he's going to die like everybody else.
Well, all the more reason to erect something in your honor, right? Because that'll live on after you.
Yeah, I suppose that's the fantasy, that somehow that was the Hitler fantasy. With his super city he wanted to build. But even that, you would think they would come to grips with the fact of, okay, so what? There's a bunch of statues around. I'm dead. What good's it going to do me?
Yeah, maybe there's a trick of the mind that they still feel that they'll be aware of that even after they're gone. I don't think they really accept that they're going to be gone. Like, if I can have a thought right now that this thing will live on in this statue for a long time, so I have to be placing myself somewhere, you know, relative to that experience, that statue will be here in 200 years from now. If I really was convinced that I'm just not going to even perceive that, then I'd agree with you. But I think they must have some sort of a assumption that they do stand in some relationship to that fame.
Yeah, I wonder that too about some of these Middle Eastern dictators, you know, who amassed apparently billions and billions and billions of dollars, and I mean, you know, some of the news reports suggest that about, you know, one of the recent countries in the news. And I scratch my head and think, so what are you going to do with all that? I mean, you know, you're an old person. You haven't got that many years left. What's the point?
Well, see, that's it. They don't have anybody telling them that they should ask that question. And since the world adores wealth, so that must be it. They imagine it's a fantasy.
Yeah.
I don't think that the mind goes that far. I think it's also another thing which is also true, is that a person, I think my definition, the thought of mortality is a very hard thing, impossible for most people to do, because how do you think about yourself not being here? It's like you're thinking that you're not thinking. Can you, because by definition, a fantasy is what you're doing right now. So how could you fantasize about not being in existence. So it's a contradiction in that very. Like, imagine that you can't imagine is basically what we're trying to tell them.
Right.
Now they get it wrong, of course. We're basically saying that you're physically not going to be in existence. But they only have a concept of physical existence. So to tell them, imagine that you can't be in this state of imagining, meaning a physical activity. So that's why it's, I think they just can't enter that area. They don't have the prerequisite knowledge to do that, to control the instinct to do that. The instinct is so tied to the immortality that they just can't even go there. And don't worry, to answer your question about the billions, they have plenty of time. They have an infinity to spend it. Yeah, but that's the lesson over here. I mean, a person who really accepts that here's an area that you do not have control of, that would be such a helpful lesson to apply to other areas, too. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up over here. Pick up next Sunday on the next verse. It goes into a new angle now. All right, so it's 8-9 that we'll start with next week. All right?
All right, Rabbi, thanks very much.
Okay, have a good week, everybody.
You too.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.